When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Mail checks, invoices, documents, and everything you need to keep your business running. Get rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS. And with the mobile app, you can take care of mailing on the go. Make the same no-brainer decisions as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up at Stamps.com with code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Prepare your ears, humans. Happy, Sad, Confused begins now.
Today on Happy, Sad, Confused, Alessandro Nivola on the biggest role of his career yet in The Many Saints of Newark. Hey guys, Josh Horowitz here with another edition of Happy, Sad, Confused, and very excited to say that this begins 2 weeks of coverage of a film that I really dug. I'm going to talk about it a lot these next two shows. Indulge me if you will. The Many Saints of Newark. I believe the subtitle is A Sopranos Story. And yes, as that subtitle alludes to, this is connected to The Sopranos, the classic, perhaps greatest television show of all time, if not the greatest, certainly up there. This week, Alessandro Nivola, who is indeed the lead of this film, playing Dickie Moltisanti, and next week, the creator of The Sopranos, David Chase. We'll get to that later on, but that's a special one as well. But as for Alessandro, if you know, you know, film and TV and theater in particular in New York, you probably know Alessandro's work. He's kind of been a character actor and a leading man over the years. And unlike some of his contemporaries, as he talks about, like the Billy Crudups and the Ethan Hawkes, he kind of hasn't had that role that really clicked, that right leading role that resonated. And here we are now. I think he's in his late 40s, and he's gotten the role that he's sought after all these years. So really thrilling to see someone like Alessandro get a chance, and only in this kind of circumstance, frankly, when David Chase wields so much power. You know, you could see this going a different way where, like, a studio would insist on a bigger, quote-unquote, name. But David Chase is the name. Sopranos is the name when it comes to The Many Saints of Newark. So exciting to see Alessandro in this, and he's fantastic in the film. This is a fun conversation. I've always been a fan of Alessandro's work. He's part of one of those cool Brooklyn couples that you got to admire as a fellow New Yorker, him and Emily Mortimer, keeping it real here in New York. And, you know, we talk a bit about this unusual trajectory for him and getting this role when he did and what it means to him now, and watching his contemporaries succeed and get opportunities where maybe he didn't. People like Billy Crudup and Ethan Hawke and Jude Law, who we knew back in the day. So he's got a good perspective about it. And again, exciting just to see him make the most of a really fun opportunity, a cool opportunity. And I should say, this isn't a spoilery conversation. Many Saints of Newark doesn't open until October 1st. It's out in theaters and on HBO Max. So don't worry, nothing spoilery at all in this chat. And if you're not even a big Sopranos fan, haven't watched the show too much or at all, this movie works, as I say to Alessandro and David on next week's show. I think it works for the casual fan, and I think it works for the diehard as well. So that is a badge of honor for The Many Saints of Newark. There's also, I should say, an amazing digression in this episode. Did you know, for instance, that Alessandro's film debut came in the great, or I don't know if it was his film debut or maybe it was his second film, Face Off. Face Off was one of his early films. He played, of course, Pollux Troy, Nick Cage's brother. A performance that is indelible. He took some big swings with that performance, and he goes into where it came from, what was on the page and what wasn't, him and Nick's relationship, how the director John Woo reacted to it. It's a fun, I don't even know, 5, maybe 10 minutes of the conversation talking all things Face Off that I just positively delighted in. And of course, we talk comfort movies as well, and he picks a great one, a Adam McKay classic. So that's today's episode of Happy, Sad, Confused, Alessandro Nivola on his life, career, and The Many Saints of Newark. Other things to mention, let's see, we still have a relatively new game night up for you guys on the Patreon page with Justin and Christian Long and Joe Manganiello. If you haven't checked that out, please do. Of course, over on the Patreon page, as always, we've got video versions of the podcast. This conversation is in video form over there. You can check out the Jessica Chastain chat in video form and a ton of other stuff. Remember, if you subscribe to the Patreon, you get all the video content, not just the new stuff, but all the stuff going way back, all the game nights, all the video versions of Happy, Sad, Confused. So check it out if you're so inclined, patreon.com/happysadconfused. Other things coming up down the pipe, what can I say? Venom, Let There Be Carnage is coming to theaters very soon. Chatted with the, what's the adjective to use on Tom Hardy? I don't know. The inscrutable, the unusual, the always charming and vaguely scary. No, he's not scary. He's a sweetie. Chatted with Tom Hardy and his director, Andy Serkis, for MTV. That conversation is coming up. That was a lot of fun to do. And some Dune stuff. I know we've been talking Dune for like years, it feels like, on the podcast. But I did mention on Twitter, so I'll mention it here. I have taped a podcast conversation with Denis Villeneuve. He, of course, one of the great filmmakers working today. And thrilled that Denis came back on the podcast. If you don't know, he was actually on before for Blade Runner 2049 a few years back. So if you want to dig into the archives for that one, check it out. But yeah, in a few weeks' time, a deep dive with Denis Villeneuve on Dune. So stick around for that one. Okay, let's get to the main event, part one of a two-week extravaganza about all things The Many Saints of Newark. Next week, it's David Chase. But today, the day belongs to Mr. Alessandro Nivola. Enjoy. Alessandro, welcome to Happy, Sad, Confused. I'm happy to say in the 7 years on this podcast, this is the first Alessandro on the pod ever. So you've broken new ground already. Welcome.
Yeah, there are a lot of firsts where Alessandro is concerned. I haven't, I don't encounter them often in this country, sometimes back in the motherland.
Right. Well, you know, if there's not, you know, if the Sopranos film, The Many Saints of Newark, doesn't call for an Alessandro, something is wrong. If you can't get a gig in this one, then you're doing something wrong.
Exactly. I mean, I've said this before in interviews, but it's really true that my name has been such a kind of source of confusion. It's been such an obstacle in my whole career up until this point. And then finally, this like
you're cashing in, cashing the chips.
Career-defining role. Finally, I'm sure I only got because of that, or it's certainly didn't slow the process down.
I don't think it got you the role with Mr. David Chase, but yes, as you say, probably didn't hurt.
He did really care. I mean, he does really care about the Italian thing. Like he. I mean, I think he makes no bones about it. Like it was important to him.
Yeah. Well, so let's start there because I mean, you talk about this as a career defining role. It's interesting. Look, you've been around the block once or twice. I followed your career. I'm a big fan of your work, man. But it's unusual for any actor to be in this circumstance where you are, because this is arguably the most important, most high profile role in your career. And as you well know, this by the Hollywood playbook is not usually how it works.
Yeah.
give me a sense of sort of like where, like, were you still, I mean, I'm sure over the years you've chased different things and you've been satisfied to different degrees. Where were you at when this came around in terms of like satisfaction level, what you were going after, what dreams were still left or what dreams you'd let go of? Where
yeah.
were you at?
Okay. I guess on the one hand, I felt like, I was very proud of the kind of range of roles that I'd played and the variety of everything. I was aware that I'd kind of, been appreciated over the years for kind of, bringing something to movies where I was playing supporting roles in that were, that was enhancing the movie somehow in unexpected ways, and that the roles were sometimes, on the page, not as colorful or interesting as they ended up in my hands once I was done with them. But I also felt like it was still a grind, it was just a grind in the sense that I You know, I just couldn't really be, you know, I couldn't finance independent movies right. in the lead roles. And, you know, studios were reluctant to hire me in lead roles just because I wasn't going to sell the film to their audiences. And so, you know, I've been relatively anonymous apart from like in the, you know, people in the know within the industry. And, right. and, obviously there were a lot of directors who wanted to hire me and, you know, came up against opposition from, you know, financiers and executives and stuff like that. And so, yeah. So like, you know, from that point of view, it's been hard. I've spent most of my career making more out of roles than right. what was there. On the other hand, I've felt over the past 8 years or so, like a kind of very like quiet, slow, steady progression towards this moment. Like getting this role wasn't completely out of nowhere. Like there had been a certain kind of like quietly building momentum, and really it started from 8 years ago or so. I made a decision to start taking roles based almost exclusively on the director. And so I started really doing smaller roles in movies that were more high profile because they were with kind of auteurish directors who were important that everybody was, you know, paying attention to and wanted to see what their next project was, which was inevitably something kind of unusual and special and attention grabbing. And so I started having a lot more people see my work, even though it was in smaller roles. I mean, I'd done like, I counted like 12 movies that I'd made that I was the lead role in that never got released, you know, over the course of my career. And these weren't like necessarily, you know, totally invisible things. They were like me starring opposite Chris Walken, me starring, I mean, like, you know, big, potentially, you know, I shouldn't say big movies, but like things that were not like shot on your handy cam in your backyard. They were,
and does that fuck with your confidence over the years? I mean, you know, you're a quality actor, but at the end, but then you're also like facing this reality of like, wait, what am I doing wrong? Like, or was it like, do you have enough knowledge of the industry and kind of presence of mind to know like, look, it's out of my hand. Like, this is just one of those things. I have plenty of friends that for whatever reason, it never clicked for, and I just have to keep doing my thing and let the chips fall where they may, or what was your attitude?
Well, you know, I felt, so, you know, with a lot of these kinds of movies that would come out, like I'd get like great reviews, you know, and
yeah.
And so I was being told, you know, by critics and stuff like that I'd given some great performance in this thing. It was just nobody was seeing any of it.
Right, right.
And so I wasn't thinking like, oh, like my process is not yielding like the performances that I want. Like it was just like I was in the wrong movies and or, you know, or just having bad luck with
right.
the movies and the way that they were, you know, released or whatever. And, but really I felt like it was about, you know, trying to come to realize that movies really belong to directors and that, a movie is only as good as its director. And, once I started just kind of saying like, I want to work with these people, like just find me anything in movies with, you know, this list of like 40 directors. And they started doing that. And, you know, it started around the time I did like, I don't know, maybe it was Ginger and Rosa with Sally Potter. Like if you yep. look from that film until totally. Now, like the best directors I've worked with are like in that, from that point to now. I mean, every movie was somebody, David O. Russell, J.C. Chander, Nick Reffin,
yeah, Ava DuVernay.
I mean, like it just every single time it was somebody. I mean, Ava, I did like a one scene part in that movie.
Yeah,
But like the aggregate of it just started to sort of snowball a little bit. Like people just became more and more aware that I was just again and again, like popping up in these movies and doing something surprising. So by the time this thing came along, I felt like something was going to happen, but you know, the clock was ticking too, because this isn't the time that you know, of a career, as you said, that you normally kind of, have your breakthrough or your career defining role or whatever, however you want to describe it. But, and in fact, this movie to me is just like a total anomaly in the sense that, studios don't make these kinds of movies anymore. These are like, classic crime dramas that were, the studio fare from the 70s and 80s, before all the, superhero movies and everything. And they just like a mid budget, this was like $50, $60 million. Like that budget is just not a budget that exists yes. at the studios, for a drama. It was, I kind of like to think of the movie as a Trojan horse that was, wrapped up in this IP of the television series that was had such a following and was only allowed to be made because of that. And it's also because of that David was allowed to cast whoever he wanted in the roles because we weren't selling it. Like the show was selling the movie. So. The likelihood of this role in this kind of movie at this time really was, very, very kind of needle in a haystack. There's no question that when it came along, I was aware that finally something had really gone right for me. And I'd had some, it was a great stroke of luck,
What was it a process in terms of like from the first time you met with David and or Alan Taylor to get the role? I mean, were you stealing yourself for like as much as they're saying, we love you, you're great, we're talking to the studio, is a part of your brain like, okay, like great, when does Ryan Gosling take my role? Like at the last second,
Yeah, I was. I gave a killer audition and I really prepared for it. I don't do a lot of auditions in a year, but I do, once every 3 months it's kind of been, and I really like treat them like, I treat them as if I had the role and I was researching the role and starting to work on it. And because just psychologically that way I can just see it for its own value and just like enjoy that process of discovering a character and picking apart a scene and, doing all the things that I do when I'm actually preparing to shoot. So I really, I spent a few weeks on this and I was given like the five biggest scenes in the movie to tape. And I didn't know, by the way, David is so, tight-lipped about the script and everything, and he's so paranoid about it getting out that I hadn't even read the whole thing, so I didn't even know it was the lead role in the movie. I just knew there were like five great scenes and so I prepared them and I taped it, and you just know, like sometimes you know if it's good or not. I just knew it was really good, and I sent it off and I was expecting to hear like something positive about it, but I didn't know. And I remember Ethan Hawke is my buddy and he lives down the road right here, just a few townhouses down on my street here in Brooklyn. And we have breakfast all the time. Our kids are in the same school. And so we meet up almost daily if we're like in the same, if we're both here. And I was like, hey, I gotta show you this thing, so I took him back to the house and I showed him the audition and he was like, damn, that's really good. You're not going to get it.
I know. He's tempering your expectations. He wanted it to be a nice surprise.
He was like, oh, you so deserve to get this. You're not going to get it. And Yeah, I of course there was always that expectation, but I definitely felt like I had like really sort of, you know, done something special with the scenes, and I'd sent them off, and I heard immediately that they were interested, and then when I went and met them, I went and had lunch with David and Alan Taylor at some restaurant in Tribeca, and you know, my next door neighbor, who's right across the wall behind this screen I'm pointing at, is Tim Van Patten, who directed Half the Sopranos and all of Boardwalk and everything.
Oh, this is all meant to be. Come on.
So once I told him that, like, I'd done this audition and they were interested and everything, he said, and I told him I was going to meet David and everything, he kind of like prepped me about the whole thing and said, listen, like, don't expect David to laugh at your jokes. You know, he's totally inscrutable. You're not going to get anything out of him. It doesn't mean he doesn't like you. Just don't expect any of that. And so I went in there just thinking like, oh my God, this is just going to be like a kind of painful lunch that I just have to sort of suffer through and hopefully not put my foot in my mouth. And instead he was just like really animated, and, you know, we just really immediately had a kind of connection, and he was so curious about my, you know, father's side of my family, the immigrant side, and you know, what his experience had been and everything. And there was, we're back full circle. This was, you know, back to my name value here.
Right. Well, I'm glad you had that experience with David. I mean, I had him on the podcast. I'm not sure if I'm going to run you or him first, but he's a tough nut to crack for many. I feel like he doesn't suffer fools, clearly. I mean, I knew what I was getting into. I've seen many interviews with him, but like, man, like, I can only imagine, like, obviously this is his baby and he doesn't want to exploit this IP, as it were. And as you say, this is kind of a Trojan horse. Like, this is like, I'll be honest, like, I hadn't watched The Sopranos for many years. I didn't remember all the intricacies of it, but like, I ended up falling in love with this movie just on its own terms, and like remembering some references, but then wanting to go back to the show and then having it enrich the experience all the more. So
yeah.
As I said to him, I think you guys really truly knocked it out of the park, and I think it's going to work for audiences.
Wow, that's great to hear. I mean, I'm only just now starting to talk to people who've seen it, because, you know, they really hadn't screened it a lot for many months. I think partly because David really felt like, you know, he was up against the fact of you know, the show being the provenance of the movie is like a double-edged sword, because on the one hand, it's made the movie possible, and on the other hand, it makes it that much harder to kind of get people to experience the movie on its own terms as a piece of cinema and not as another episode of the show. And so I think, you know, then with the HBO Max, you know, day and date release with the theatrical, David really, like, his heart sank, because he feels like our movie has a handicap of like needing to overcome the, you know, the association with HBO and the, you know, television incarnation of the series. So I think that's been something that he's been very like vocal about, and he makes no bones about it. He's just like, this is bullshit.
I mean, I like a refreshing filmmaker that says what he thinks. I mean, look, again, it's his baby and he should feel protective of it. And it's a tough nut to crack in this environment, but it's, as a cinephile, as somebody that appreciates exactly what you're talking about, that kind of mid-range drama, you don't see it much. And like, I hope it's rewarded. I hope people give it a shot at the box office as well as at home.
I mean, the box office thing is just like, so confusing at this point, because
nobody knows.
Especially with this movie, probably more than any, because like people, as he's pointed out, like people just associate The Sopranos with their television. So like, I don't think people think of this movie as something that needs to be seen in a cinema. And when in fact, in my opinion, and maybe I'm biased, but I don't think so. Like, I have a pretty clear eye about the stuff I'm in, but forget about the quality of the storytelling or the acting or any of the other sort of film craft parts of it. Like, the cinematography I really love in the movie. Like, I really think it's so much more cinematic than the show was. And that's not to like you know, put the show down at all. The show is an absolute, you know, genius piece of television, and it's changed the course of TV and the acting, and it's outrageous and it's just brilliantly written. But just purely, like, as far as the way it's shot, like the way it captures the period feels very like gritty and authentic, but not like glamorized, but it's also beautiful in a kind of subtle way. And so to me, like, the experience of watching it on a big screen is so much better than seeing it on television. But I don't think that that's the perception of the movie, given its association with the show. So,
well, all we can do is talk it up. And I will say, as I said to David, I think I've probably seen like maybe 9 or 10 movies on the big screen in the last year and a half, in the last couple months. And I've seen yours twice on the big screen. So hopefully that tells you all you need to know.
Is the second time, were you forced?
No. I wanted a refresher for both you and David.
Like, it was like the scene in Clockwork Orange. They had like your eyelids, like held open. No. You were strapped down into a chair.
Yeah. It was a saw device I was stuck in. Let's talk, if we could, a little bit about your background, if you'll indulge me. How did you catch the disease of acting? Who inflicted it upon you? Was it in your blood from the beginning? Where did you kind of fall in love?
I was in Peter Pan in a school play, and I just got, you know, I just got really fired up about it. That was third grade, I guess. And I told my mom I wanted to go to acting classes. And so she found like summer programs for me to go to. And then from there, it was really like a very old fashioned road, you know. And again, it was kind of like, you know, slow and steady, which I guess it just carried on right to this point. I started out doing, you know, summer drama schools and things. And then interning at summer theaters and like sweeping floors and punching meal tickets and doing like splicing sound tape and for plays. And then I started getting little roles in professional summer theater up in Connecticut. There was this place called the Eugene O'Neill Theater Center where they developed all of August Wilson's plays and John Patrick Shanley's plays, John Guare's plays, back in the 80s. And I was there initially just as a kind of intern who was like helping out. And then my fourth or fifth summer there, I was still in high school, and some part came up for a teenager, and they asked me to do it. And then that was like my first professional role. And then I went to Yale, and while I was at Yale, I got an agent, and whoops, something just happened to my thing there. And I started auditioning for, you know, summer theater. And I then, like, over the time that I was at Yale, I did like 5 regional theater plays around the country, Chekhov and Athel Fugard and a bunch of things, you know, Master Harold and the Boys, I think, was like my first big lead role in any professional capacity. And it was out in Seattle at the Intimum Theater in Seattle. And that was, I think I was a junior at Yale, and it was, one of the most thrilling moments of my life. And I was maybe 16 or something, 17. And then a year out of Yale, I was cast. I was living in New York. I hadn't ever worked in New York City. And my first role in New York was a starring role on Broadway opposite Helen Mirren in a Turgenev play called A Month in the Country. And I had never done a film at this point. I was just, my whole career was geared towards the theater. But that sort of like changed everything, just in terms of like my awareness of Hollywood and stuff, because there were all these young actors who were also on Broadway at that time. There was Billy Crudup, Jude Law, Damian Lewis, Ralph Fiennes, Rufus Sewell, Robert Sean Leonard, like all these people. And we were all kind of hanging out together at night after these shows, and we would do our plays and meet up and have these kind of like, you know, really long nights.
were they highfalutin dreams? Like, were you guys snobbish about like Hollywood at the time? Like, what was the attitude? What was the collective kind of like, what was the dream collectively or for yourself at that time in your life?
Well, I got really close friends. I got to be really close friends with Jude Law in particular. And he and I were just kind of like, for a few months when we were doing these plays, we were just hanging out together the whole time. And I just remember, like, he was at CAA, and he was just like very glamorous guy at that time. You know, he had this like bleach blonde hair, and he was all kind of like a wild man and wore kind of like crazy fashion-y clothes that were sort of, you know, like definitely eye-catching. And like, he was just like, you know, whether or not he was famous, he was going to be famous. Like, you walk down the street and you're like, who's that guy? You know, like, and I was kind of like fascinated by him. And, you know, we just like, we really got along, but I started noticing like all these film strips. I remember going over to his apartment, and there was like a stack of red film scripts with this red CAA covers on them, and they were obviously just like, I guess, film offers he'd been getting, because like, wow, he was a star somehow already, you know. And and so like the second his show closed, off he went, and he's just started making movies. And then that's kind of started happening with a lot of the other guys. I mean, I, you know, Billy, same thing. I can't remember what he went off to do, but like, they one by one started, their shows started closing, and they started floating off, you know, up towards the heavens. And I was kind of left there like grinding out my play every night. And like, you know, I didn't have any film offers, and but someone did come and see the show. Mindy Marin, this cast, great casting director, and she, you know, got excited about me being in John Woo's Face Off movie, and so that came out of the play. It wasn't immediately after the play. It was like, I don't know, it was maybe a year later or something, but she had seen the play and she'd remembered me, and she brought me in to meet him. And so that's, you know, how that happened. And then after that first play in New York, I didn't do another play for 8 years.
Oh, wow. We should talk about Face Off, because like, I mean, that is one, and like, you made such like an indelible impression as Pollux Troy. I mean, I was like refreshing. Not that I need refreshing. I've seen that movie so many times, and what John Woo did with it, and Nick and John Travolta, the whole, and Joan Allen, everybody's just amazing in it. But I was looking on YouTube. I was just curious, like, to watch some scenes. And there's like literally like a sizzle reel. There's like just like somebody has comped all of the Pollux Troy lines, all of your moments. I don't know if you've seen
that. That character, not me as an actor, but that character, like, somehow got a sort of weird cult following going with it. Like, I don't know.
You're making choices. You're making big choices with that character. I mean, like, you could, you know, talk to me about, like, was that all in the page? I mean, like, the pinky wave, there's just an affectation to him that is very striking and unique.
None of it was on the page. In fact, when I first met John Woo, the role was written like just like mini me of Nick's character. It was like the same guy as Nick, just sort of like this sort of loser, less cool one, but who was still like, you know, supposed to be in like leather pants and, you know, like a kind of club guy, you know, who's just like trying to like be like his older brother or something. I don't know. But it was just so lame. Like, I knew from the start, first of all, I thought the script was just totally inane. Like, I couldn't understand. Like, I was like, these guys are swapping faces. This is the stupidest thing I've ever heard. Like, this is never going to work.
Right.
And, I was so wrong for a million reasons. Like, now, like, forget about John Woo's style. I even think the script is brilliant and the whole concept is brilliant. But at the time, I just thought it was so dumb. And then I The role just seemed like there was nothing interesting about it. It just seemed like a kind of carbon copy of Nick, and I could never do Nick better than Nick. And so but he cast me just from, I think we just met. I don't think I read anything. I just like, I came and met him and I wore leather pants. Like I wore leather pants to my John Woo meeting, and that did the trick. Like he cast me. But then in the time that I was kind of preparing, I was just thinking, I have got to completely rethink this thing, because otherwise it's going to be just so forgettable. And I'd been watching that Terry Zwigoff documentary about R. Crumb, the artist R. Crumb, which, you know, I don't know how many people have seen this. Maybe it's an obscure thing, but it's a brilliant documentary about this psychedelic cartoon artist from the sort of Haight-Ashbury. And he had, it was not just him, but two brothers, and they were all like really eccentric, fascinating characters. And I started fixating on his older brother, Charles, who sadly killed himself after the documentary was made. But he was this really weird guy who wrote these journals where the writing got like smaller and smaller and smaller until like you couldn't see it anymore. I basically decided I was just going to do an impersonation of him. And he had like a very specific voice, you know, where he sort of talked like that and all this stuff, you know, like everything was in the back of his throat. And I just sort of started like, I was like, I'm just going to do that. I'm just going to be that guy. And then I want to dress like him. And I went to the costumers and I had them rethink the whole thing. And they got all my like, you know, wide wheel corduroys and sweater vests and glasses and all that stuff. And my whole physicality, I was sort of imitating the Crumb brothers. And I had also shown it to Nick, who just like, his like eyes lit up when he saw the documentary. He was like, oh, Al Shimango,
you're speaking the Cage's language. Like, you know. What you're doing.
Very dark. You know, he was just like into it. And we started like getting together and doing like improvisations in his trailer, you know, based on the Crumb brothers, and just like cracking ourselves up, just making up the most absurd shit, talking about like sex sandwiches and like, I mean, just free associating. And his assistant would write it all down, and then we would send it to John Woo, and John Woo just loved it. Like, I couldn't believe it. Like, the stuff we were coming up with was just so like random, and he would watch it and he loved it. I remember him saying, like, bringing us into the set one day and saying, he was looking at our pages and he was like, sex sandwich, very funny. And we were like, you know,
that's amazing.
It was like just wildly creative experience. Nick, you know, it was my first movie, really. I mean, I had done a little tiny role by that time in Inventing the Abbots, and that was it. And Nick was like so encouraging of me, and he was just like, yeah, you know, just, you know, go, like, do that, you know. And so I just felt totally emboldened by him. And John, like, the you know, the rest of the movie was one of those movies is so big and there's so much going on that nobody's paying attention to what the acting, like, you know, that's happening off in some kind of corner. And it's not until, like, you know, the dailies started coming back that people had realized, like, that I was doing this whacked out character. Before that, they were just like, who's the guy with the boat shoes and the corduroys or whatever? Yeah.
Why is that guy waving to John Travolta like this in the corner?
But I started getting people coming up to me on the set from the crew, you know, like the DP, I think, and I don't know, people in the, you know, in the department head saying, like, hey, I saw the dailies, like, I like what you're doing there, you know what I mean? And I was like, all right, like, I'm good. I'm just going to keep doing this. And
that's amazing.
So, wow. Yeah, that was a very a great first experience.
We'll have to set aside another 3 hours for another podcast to talk more in detail, because I feel like that's the tip of the iceberg of Face Off stories and Nick Cage stories, which I can always dine out on. one thing I want to get to before I run out of time with you, because I have been asking folks for about their comfort movies, especially in this last year when we need some comfort.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You chose a great one that shockingly has not come up yet. I don't know. This is a stupid question to even ask why this is a comfort movie, but tell me why for you, Step Brothers is an integral comfort movie for you.
It's become a family thing. My brother and my son and I just all love it so much that we just, it's just like we quote it all day long to each other in text messages, and like we send little pictures, and we just repeat the same lines to each other over and over again. And it's just like, we just like crack each other up, even like with the same lines that we've said to each other like 100 times. And I don't know, man, it's just so brilliant. And like, I think maybe the best performance in the whole movie is Adam Scott. You know, like Will Ferrell and John C. Reilly are just such geniuses in like every movie that they do. And Will Ferrell is like, I think all of his movies are my comfort movies, but Adam Scott is like the special sauce in the movie that just like puts it into the stratosphere. And from the minute he appears on screen, like singing, Sweet Child of Mine or whatever, with his family, and like, he's on fire. He like had tapped into somebody that was just so brilliant. And that character has been kind of recreated in other movies and other kind of incarnations so many times, and it'll just never be as good as the way that he does it.
What's funny, and I don't know if you know Adam at all. I mean, I've talked to him on this podcast and other times, and he's talked about that film like being so out of his element and being like, I am not equipped to do this. And to see what came of it, even through the fear and feeling like you didn't belong, makes it all the more remarkable.
Well, that's so funny. Like, he just seems so completely there. I mean, I know that feeling. Like, I just, you know, interestingly, like after this movie, the last three things I've done have all been like very, you know, like real comic roles. And I've done comic roles at times in my career, but usually in more dramatic films. And after doing The Art of Self-Defense a few years ago,
by the way, fantastic.
Thank you. well, that was like my first like out and out like comedy film, and just, you know, with me and Jesse Eisenberg, and I started getting offered like just comedies for after that, and so my role in David O. Russell's movie, and then the thing I did after that was like with all those guys, like it was Alison Brie and Aubrey Plaza and Fred Armisen and Molly Shan and Tim Heidecker, Zach Woods, like a whole long list of like the sort of UCB.
The all-stars, yeah, yeah, totally.
Yeah, and it's amazing how separate the two worlds are. Like, those guys all know each other and they've all worked together a million times. And I now feel like I've worked with like everybody, but it turns out it's only in this like one side of the movie business. And I was like dropped into their midst on this film. And I felt like the way Adam's describing, like I felt like a total alien, to the point where it was almost like they were like wanting to come and like touch my hair, you know what I mean, and see if I was real. And it was such a like just so fun. And I would just sit around like I it was as if I was stoned when I wasn't stoned, because like, my eyes were like slits, and I was just like grinning, like, because people just the whole time were just being funny all the time. And it's so unlike all the film sets I've been on, where, you know, I don't know, you know, people are sort of just sitting around like complaining or whatever.
to be fair, some of those performers are very, I mean, like Aubrey Plaza, I mean, I've known Aubrey for a decade and I still don't even know if she's like giving me shit or being normal or what's coming out of her mouth and where her brain's at. It's like,
she's like a total whack job in the best possible way. Oh, like, she's 1,000%. Just amazing. Amazing.
Talk to me, you mentioned David O. Russell, who you've of course worked on, worked with before. You've collaborated again with him on this new film that has another insane bananas cast. I don't know much
this
about
movie,
it.
Like, if you weren't in this movie, your career is over.
Yeah, between Adam McKay's new one, right? The one with like Leo and everybody, and this one, it casts all of Hollywood. So at least you made it, man. So you say that this one's pretty comedic. I mean, do you click with David? David's obviously, again, talk about a guy on his own wavelength, like a very unique personality to work with. Did you click with him immediately? Is it a different environment on this new one versus American Hustle? What can you say about working with David?
Well, he's the only director who's ever cast me twice.
What? that's crazy.
Yeah, this is the first time that's ever happened. Wow. So, you know, it working with him is just completely unlike any other experience. It's totally feels totally out of control. You have to kind of give yourself over to him in a way that is really terrifying because you can't like. I mean, the way you prepare for his movies is all with character work. Right, so it's all about developing behavior and just being really specific about who you're playing and how they talk and how they are physically. And if you really latch onto that in a very detailed way, then you just like filter through his dialogue. I mean, you don't ever say anything that's in the script. So,
wow.
And he's written the script and the scripts are always really excellent. But what you say on the day comes out of like, he tucks himself in next to the camera and has like a little monitor and just starts like interacting with you during the takes while the camera's rolling, and he becomes kind of part of the scene. Like you'll be in a scene with other people, but he talks almost like I liken it to like Glenn Gould. I don't know if you've ever listened to Glenn Gould recordings. He was a famous pianist, classical pianist who famously recorded Bach, you know, the Brandenburg concertos or whatever. And he used to like sing the notes as he was playing them, right, like vocally out loud. And so if you listen to recordings of him, like you hear him going like,
right.
Whatever, like, and you know, David like is, he's interacting with you as he's kind of directing the scenes almost while the camera's rolling. So he's actually like yelling out dialogue for you to say. And you may repeat lines a whole bunch of times and he'll tell you to say something else. And then you say that and then another thing. And then you say that. And then he'll tell the other guy in your scene to say something. And then he'll tell the camera where to go. And it becomes this kind of like psychedelic chaos, but it's an amazing feeling. You just kind of like give yourself over to being manipulated. Right. By someone else. And if you like are like, if you have the character and you're comfortable enough in the character and you can say anything, it doesn't matter, you're still the guy. It's like you just kind of let go. And and he's very funny, so the thing, usually the stuff he's asking you to say are jokes, you know, or you know, funny things, and you just say it like totally committed, and it just is funny.
Well, it makes sense why, like, obviously so many actors are attracted to him, because I mean, like, we all heard the stories and we know he's kind of can be like, you know, up and down in interesting ways, like that tightrope of like terrifying and invigorating for an actor is like unlike any other. I can't think of another filmmaker that works that way. So that's.
Yeah. I mean, it's really like, it's really by the end of the shoot, you feel just like exhausted by the uncertainty of everything, like of coming in every day and just like not knowing what you're going to say or what's going to happen, or, you know, if the scene is going to just like blow up and be just some like completely different thing than what you anticipated, and that something brilliant is going to be discovered and some incredibly funny moment, and it's just going to like be a memorable moment or something, or if it's just going to like, you know, if you're not whatever, like your role's presence in the scene is going to end up just being totally invisible. Like you just don't know
right.
on any given day. And that after like a couple of months, it's like, it's intense and can, you know, you need like a rest after. But I was very excited to be asked to work with him again, because I mean, I recently watched one of the scenes. I very rarely have gone back and watched things that I've been in the past, but somebody sent me on Twitter or something, some scene from American Hustle with me and Bradley and Louis C.K. And I just watched it. I just like, I mean, it was just so unlike any other movie. And it was so funny and alive. Like it just felt alive.
No, and alive is the word. There is a palpable energy to his work, and it's the movement of the camera, but it's also just like that ineffable kind of spontaneity that clearly comes from the process you're talking about. And you're kind of shedding light on like what I've not been able to kind of put my finger on in his films over the years. And now I'm kind of starting to get it of like how that happens. So I
don't know if maybe some of his other, and by the way, some people, it doesn't work for some people. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
Like,
right.
And you know, some people have had experiences with him that, you know, haven't gone so well. And I don't know. I've just, you know, I've had like fairly limited, you know, I wasn't the lead in either of these movies, and I was just coming in and doing my bit. But I, as a purely on a creative level, I found it thrilling on both occasions.
Well, we only have to wait like a year for that one. So we'll.
I know, it's like every movie I do now. It's like 3 years later. It's unbelievable. The patience of Job at this point.
It just means we'll have another excuse to chat as and we'll also have to do, we're going to do our 10-hour face-off podcast coming soon. But in the short term, to the audience one more time, if you can't tell, I'm a big fan of this one, The Many Saints of Newark. If you're a Sopranos fan, obviously you're going to see this, you're going to want to see this, but like as somebody that like loved Sopranos but was not like just like crazy invested, it just works on its own, and it's just like a really well-told and amazing ensemble. I should mention too, beyond Alessandro, like everyone from Vera and Corey Stoll, my god, Ray Liotta, I don't want to reveal too much, but the scenes between you and Ray are electric and amazing. So
I've got some stories there too, for our next chat.
Okay, fair enough.
That was a thrilling experience. Ray is something else. He's amazing.
Yeah, no, he's amazing in the film, truly. Congratulations, man, on this. I hope you get a breather from both David O. Russell and the publicity train to enjoy the moment. It's a long overdue to have this moment. So congratulations, man. And thanks for the time.
Thanks, Josh. It's good to connect.
And so ends another edition of Happy, Sad, Confused. Remember to review, rate, and subscribe to this show on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm a big podcast person. I'm Daisy Ridley, and I definitely wasn't pressured to do this by Josh.